Chapter 1, Youth. Thursday, November 22nd, 1787. Paris, Hotel de Cherbourg, Rue du Four, Saint-Honoré. I had come out of the Italians and was walking rapidly along the alleys of the Palais Royal. That tumult of strong emotions peculiar to my temperament made me indifferent to the cold for a time. But as my imagination cooled, I became conscious of its severity and sought the shelter of the arcades. I was at the threshold of the iron gates when my eyes fell upon a woman. The time and place, no less than her general appearance and her extreme youth, left no doubt in my mind as to her calling. She stopped, and I noticed that her bearing was not in the least brazen, but had a certain propriety that harmonized with her personality. This, the next word is illegible, impressed me. Encouraged by her timidity, I spoke to her. I, whose repugnance to her class is such that I feel myself contaminated by a glance from one of its members. But her pale complexion, her frail physique, and her soft voice decided me at once. Either, said I to myself, this is a person who will be useful to me for the observation I wish to make, or a mere simpleton. You are very cold, I began. How can you venture into these alleys? Ah, sir, the cold refreshes me. I must finish my evening. The indifference of her manner, the businesslike nature of her reply interested me, and I turned to walk by her side. You look very delicate. I am surprised at your taking to such a calling. I will, sir. One must do something. Certainly. But are there no other pursuits of a healthier kind? No, sir. One must live. I was delighted. I saw that she was willing at least to answer my questions, a measure of success which had not always crowned similar attempts on my part. You must be a native of some northern district, as you bear the cold so well. I come from Nantes in Brittany. I know it well. Mademoiselle, you must tell me your story. How came you to lose your virtue? I was seduced, sir, by an officer. And do you regret your fall? Oh, yes, indeed. Her voice took on a sweetness and unction I had not before remarked. My sister is comfortably married, and I might have been as she is. How did you get to Paris? The officer who ruined me and whom I hate deserted me. I fled from my mother's anger. A second presented himself and brought me to Paris. He left me in his turn and was succeeded by a third with whom I lived 3 years. Oh, a Frenchman. He was called to London on business and is there now. Let me come home with you. What shall we do there? Oh, we can warm ourselves and then. I had no scruples in the matter. I had led her on in order that she might not be able to escape when pressed by the train of reasoning I had prepared while counterfeiting a severity I determined to show her was not natural to me. When he wrote the above, Bonaparte was 18 years and 3 months old. He was born on August 15, 1769. There is every reason to suppose that this was the first woman to whom he had addressed himself. A hasty glance through the records of his childhood will suffice to show the grounds of this conviction. The more important dates he noted himself, and where it has been possible to verify these, they have proved scrupulously exact. He left for Ajaccio for France on December 15, 1778, at the age of 9 years and a half. His feminine reminiscences of his native isle centered around his foster mother, Camilla Carboni. Afterwards, the widow Harry, his elderly nurses, and a little schoolfellow, La Giacobinetta, of whom he often spoke at St. Helena. In his later life, he showered benefits upon his foster mother, upon her daughter, Madame Tavera, and her granddaughter, Madame Poli, to whom he had himself given the name of Faustina at her baptism. If he did nothing for his foster brother, Ignacio Harry, it was because the latter espoused the English cause at an early age and entered the British Navy. One of the nurses, Minana Severia, remained in Madame Bonaparte's service till her death. The other, Mamuccia Caterina, died long before the empire, as did the little Jacquinetta, whose childish tears Napoleon had so often dried during his sojourn at the College of Autun from January 1st to May 12th, 1779, at Brienne from May 1779 to October 14th, 1784, at the Military College in Paris, where he spent a year from October 22nd, 1784 to October 30th, 1785, we find no mention of any woman. If, as Madame d'Abrantes states, he spent a week at Monsieur Perron's house, Number 5 plus Conti, contrary to the regulations of the military school to recover from a sprain, it was when he had just completed his 16th year. Any adventure prior to that of November 22nd, 1787 could therefore only have taken place between the dates of his quitting the military school and of his return to Paris. But if Bonaparte started for Valence on October 30th, 1785, he left Valence for Corsica during the term on September 16, 1786, after a sojourn of less than a year. He did not return from Corsica till September 12, 1787, on which occasion he made the journey to Paris. His emancipation did not take place in Corsica nor at Valence during the 10 months of his first sojourn. He was known there as a shy, somewhat melancholy youth, much engrossed in study, but anxious nevertheless to make a good impression and find a favorable reception in society. Monseigneur de Tardivon, Abbé of Saint-Ruf, to whom he had been recommended by the Marbeufs, and who, as a mitred dignitary and general of his order, took the lead in social life at Valence, introduced him to some of the best houses, among others, to those of Madame Grégoire de Colombier, Madame Aubervie de Saint-Germain, and Madame de Laurencin. These ladies, especially the two latter, were among the best-bred people in the province, members of the lesser nobility or of the more aristocratic section of the middle class. They were very particular about the conduct of the officers they admitted into their circle, and would not allow any intercourse between their daughters and young men whose morals could be called into question. Bonaparte, though he was but 17, and the lady was older, seems to have had some vague idea of a marriage with Caroline de Colombier, whose mother allowed her rather more liberty than was usual, but the mutual fancy they may have felt for one another resulted only in a chaste and reserved courtship of a somewhat infantile character, quite in the spirit of Rousseau, the Rousseau of Mademoiselle Galli. Bonaparte may have said to himself when gathering cherries with Mademoiselle de Colombier, "Would that my lips were cherries. How gladly would I offer them to her." Thus, she soon became the wife of Monsieur Garampal de Brissieu, a retired officer, who took her to live at his country house near Lyon. Nearly 20 years later, towards the end of the year 7, Napoleon, who had never met his cherry gatherer again, received a letter from her at the camp of Boulogne, recommending her brother to his notice. He replied by return of post, promising to take the first opportunity of serving Monsieur de Colombier and assuring Madame Caroline de Brissieu that his recollections of her and of her mother had always been among his most interesting memories. "I see by your letter," he continues, "that you live near Lyon, and I take it somewhat ill that you did not come to the city during my stay there, for it would have been a great pleasure to me to meet you." The hint was not lost on Madame de Brissieu. When the emperor passed Lyon on his way to be crowned at Milan, Germain, now 22, year 8, April 12, 1806, she was one of the first to greet him. She was much changed in age, a mere shadow of the fair Caroline of his youth. In spite of what the emperor granted, every request she made, erasures from the lists of emigres, a post for her husband, a lieutenancy for her brother, in January January 1806, she wrote to the emperor for the new year, inquiring after his health. He replied himself at once. In 1808, he appointed her lady-in-waiting to his mother and appointed Monsieur de Bressieux president of the Electoral College of Isere. In 1810, he made him a baron of the empire. Such was the grateful remembrance in which he held all who had shown him kindness in his youth, that there was not one among them whose fortune he did not make, and whose name was not often on his lips during his captivity. To women he showed, if possible, a double portion of his gratitude. Even when he had good reason to bear the malice, it was enough that they had once felt kindly towards him to make him forget the rest. Thus, Mademoiselle de Lobervie de Saint-Germain, whom he once thought of marrying, preferred her cousin, Monsieur Bacasson de Montalivet, a native like herself of Valence and a comrade of Napoleon's. Bonaparte showed no resentment, and it is notorious how richly Monsieur de Montalivet benefited by his friendship, receiving successively the posts of Prefect of the Manche and of Seine-et-Oise, Director General of Roads and Bridges, Minister of the Interior and Count of the Empire, with a settlement of 80,000 francs. Madame de Montalivet, whose virtues he had once loved as much as he had admired her beauty, as he himself puts it, he appointed lady-in-waiting to the Empress in 1806. She accepted the post on certain conditions. Your Majesty, she said, knows my convictions as to woman's mission here below. The much coveted honor you graciously bestow on me would become a misfortune to my mind if it prevented me from nursing my husband when he has the gout, or my children if Providence should grant me any. The emperor frowned at first, but presently bowed graciously. Ah, Madame de Montalivet, you make conditions, and I'm not used to that. However, I submit, you must be lady-in-waiting, and matters shall be arranged that your duties as wife and mother shall not be neglected. Madame de Montalivet was exempted from regular attendance, and Napoleon never failed to treat her with special distinction. He had a great affection for the whole family. They are scrupulously honest, he used to say, and sincerely affectionate. I have every confidence in their attachment. Such were the cherished memories Napoleon carried away from Valence. They are such as any young girl might be proud to inspire. No other intimacies are recorded, even in his most private notes, which show him as an Hippolytus in love with glory rather than with woman. We may quote the following in proof. If I had to draw a comparison between our own times and those of Rome and Sparta, I should say that love was the ruling power in the one, and love of country in the other. The effects of these two passions are so diverse that we may well pronounce them incompatible. It is not to be denied that a people given up to gallantry soon loses even the strength of mind necessary to conceive of the existence of patriotism. To such a condition we seem to have come into our own age. We may conclude that his adventure with the young woman of the Palais Royal was his first experience of the sort. Commonplace as it is, the episode is strongly characteristic. We recognize his misogynistic tendencies, his critical spirit, his brusque affirmations, his habit of cross-examining his interlocutor, and also his extraordinary memory, for he reproduces the girl's words, phrases, and exclamations, even the familiar expletives that proclaim her Breton origin. Did he ever see her again? Probably not. Among the papers written by him during this sojourn in Paris is one on patriotism addressed to a young lady, but this was hardly a subject of much interest to a frequenter of the Palais Royal arcades. After this sojourn in Paris, from October to December 1787, we find that Bonaparte returned once more to Corsica, where he arrived on January 1st, 1788. He spent his furlough there, rejoining his regiment at Auxonne on June 1st. We find no trace of any love affair at this period at Sur, however, where he was sent on detachment duty at the beginning of 1789. He is supposed to have made conquests of a certain Madame L., nay, and wife of the collector of the salt dues of Madame G., a farmer's wife whose dairy he visited to drink new milk, and of the daughter of the house in which he lodged. It is a good record for a term of some 25 days, during which his notebooks further prove him to have been working strenuously, but it is nevertheless true that 14 years later, on Sherman now 16, year 8, April 6, 1805, when Napoleon passed through Sur on his way to Milan, Monsieur de Tiar, his chamberlain, presented the young woman to him, and he gave her a scholarship at one of the government schools for her son, a child of 12 years old. The age of the boy precludes the idea that Napoleon may have thought it his own. If he had felt any doubts on this score, his bounty would have been not only the greater, but unsolicited.